glad to have you come there for a special D word. My guest this week is Dr. Gail Stokes from Dementia Australia. And along with Gail, we're also going to be hearing some Eastern Nutritionisms from Kate Taylor from Eat, Drink, Think Nutrition. All that to come after this from the Castellows.
Shoulder, won't you kiss my hands tonight? Won't you kiss my hands tonight? This flame is slowly rising, it's burning Georgia down. Follow this love through the dark into the red clay ground. I said into the red clay ground. Like the Mississippi, I'm coming around the bend. I can't tell you where it goes, but I know it'll never end. Lord, I know.
Castellows, and I know it will never end. My guest this week is Dr. Gail Stokes, Executive Director for Services, Engagement and Research at Dementia Australia. Gail, it's great to welcome you to the D Word as my guest. Before we really get into the subject, just give us a quick introduction about yourself and your work there at Dementia Australia.
Sure. So great to be here. I'm Kale. I'm the Executive Director of Services, Engagement and Research at Dementia Australia. It's quite a long title. I kind of need a fold-out business card to be able to fit it. But I have responsibility for all of our client-facing services in Australia, so the services that we deliver to people living with dementia and their families and carers. Also have responsibility for the way that we engage with people with living experience to make sure that when we're advocating, because we are the peak advocacy organisation, that we're drawing on as many voices and experiences as possible. And I also have responsibility for the Dementia Australia Research Foundation, which is a separate but related entity that's fully funded through donations and philanthropic grants, and we pass that on to researchers who are in the dementia field, either in biomedical or psychosocial research. So a few different things. I've been with the organisation now for, I think, coming up to 14 years. So I have been with the organisation before we unified as a single national organisation, and since then as well. So it's obviously something that keeps me here. I really enjoy the work, the variety of what I do, and working with people living with dementia and their families and carers is a gift, really. So yeah, it keeps me going.
Sounds like days are never dull.
Definitely not.
With all that going on, I mean, in terms of Australia, I'm here in the UK. You're there in Australia. You're a big, diverse country in terms of population,
For
particularly in,
sure.
we're a little island. In terms of geography, you're the complete opposite. I mean, what kind of challenges does that give you in terms of things like getting a diagnosis and
Yes.
why things fit together?
Think in some ways, some of the challenges that we have in Australia are not dissimilar to what other countries experience in terms of probably the lack of understanding or the misunderstandings around dementia and the lack of conversation around cognitive impairment and picking up symptoms early. I think that's, that seems to be something that's fairly universal, unfortunately, and it's certainly a challenge for us here in Australia. I think we probably, from a geography point of view, obviously we are a dispersed and diverse community, and we've got more than 447,000 people living with dementia currently in Australia. And they're not all exclusively living in the kind of eastern seaboard part of the country where, where there's the closest density of cities. So from a geographic point of view, getting out to people where they're at can be quite challenging. And we know that for people that are living in rural and remote areas or perhaps live in communities that aren't so well supported through services, it sharpens the acuity of need. So, people find it harder to access services. They might be more likely to go without a diagnosis because they don't have specialist diagnostic services in the area. So, whilst we're fortunate that we have a well, comparatively, a well-funded, well-supported range of programs available to people living with dementia and their families, it can still be difficult to access them.
Sure. When you do access, one of the problems we've got here, I think, is joining it all together. Dementia sometimes to me seems to be the quiet kid in the corner, where
Yes.
everybody gets things like coronary heart disease, diabetes, gets it all
Yeah.
together, clear pathways. Whereas people living with dementia, to kind of my experience of, 7 years of talking to people, is that that pathway is anything but clear.
Yeah. I think that is an unfortunate reality for people all around the world, including here in Australia. I think, we often talk about navigating the system and navigating the disease, and both of those things are really challenging. So for somebody newly diagnosed or seeking a diagnosis, there are still a variety of experiences in terms of talking to their doctor, being able to get a referral to a specialist clinic if that's required, recognizing symptoms of change early enough, being able to talk about it, and then goodness knows, what happens after that in terms of getting access to support. Unfortunately, it's still all too common for people to receive a diagnosis of dementia and be told to go home and get their affairs in order, despite the fact that there's an enormous amount that they can do to, plan for the future and make sure that they and their families and the people that are supporting them have the information and support that they need to live well. All of those things are so important to the experience of dementia, and yet they're probably not sort of routinely built into to people's pathways, as you say. And one of the biggest complaints we have is that the systems that they have to engage with, whether it be healthcare or the disability system here in Australia, which is the National Disability Insurance Scheme, or whether it's an aged care support service, trying to navigate through all of those, and the kind of volume of information and the complexity of it is just so difficult for people, and that they're trying to do that at a time when they're dealing with significant challenges and changes to their family circumstance. So it is a real challenge, and I'd like to be able to say that Australia is different and we've got a strong system of being able to navigate through, but unfortunately, that is not what people living with dementia and their families tell us. It's still incredibly complicated.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Kate's Eastern Nutritionisms are brought to you by Eat, Drink, Think Nutrition.
So, we can't talk about Easter without mentioning eggs. If allergies allow, don't forget to enjoy your classic chicken eggs at Easter, since these are rich in the micronutrient choline, the macronutrient protein, and in brain-beneficial omega-3 essential fatty acid. These nutrients directly benefit brain development and function by supporting brain cell structure and neurogenesis. This is the formation of new working brain cells. They also indirectly support verbal fluency, memory retention, and cognitive adaptability, otherwise known as neuroplasticity, which is the brain's ability to flexibly adapt to new situations and learning. An easy way to include eggs in your diet is to enjoy an omelette or scrambled or poached eggs for breakfast or brunch on Easter Monday morning.
We are many thousands of miles apart, but very, very similar. In all of that, I mean, one of the areas that could, you know, break that cycle a little bit is use of technology, which I know you've looked at. There's a lot of good tech out there that could really help us in this and kind of get everybody singing off the same hymn sheet, as it were.
Yeah, and it is difficult to get access to some of it or know where to look for stuff, right? Like that's the There is a lot out there, but then trying to navigate your way through what's a good piece of technology versus something that's perhaps not as useful, because I'm sure it's the same over there, but there's always advertisements and things about, you know, reducing your risk of developing dementia, or download this game and you won't develop dementia, or, you know, there's all sorts of technologies out there that can be helpful for, you know, for keeping engaged or keeping your brain active or keeping families connected, making sure that, there's sort of assistive technology that can remind people on the sorts of things to do to live well when they're living in their own home, especially, you know, where they might be living on their own, for example. But trying to figure out what's the best pieces of technology can be quite challenging. But we've particularly focused on technology that's experiential. So we've, over the last kind of decade or so, built up a suite of products that are really about demystifying the experience of dementia and putting the user of the technology into the shoes of someone living with dementia. So a lot of the education that we deliver is a mixture of, you know, kind of more traditional forms of education, but then also this experiential form. So it uses virtual reality goggles, and you basically put yourself in the shoes of somebody living with dementia. And we found that that's been incredibly powerful, both for people that are supporting someone living with dementia in a professional capacity, so a formal carer, but also for family members as well, because it just shifts the dial a little bit on understanding the experience of dementia in a more direct way. And I think, you know, having done the education myself, once you've experienced it, you can't unexperience it. So once you've kind of had that aha moment, it sticks with you, and it does tend to profoundly then shape the way that you engage with or interact with someone living with dementia, because you kind of get that sense of understanding, you know, where they might be coming from. And obviously it's, you know, always dependent on the individual and how they're experiencing it, but it does give just that additional level of insight that can kind of shift someone's understanding of how someone is experiencing dementia, and that is really powerful.
Yeah, the thing is, you know, that's already, we've got a kind of virtual dementia experience, I think, they call it here in the UK. And, you know, one of the things that we've always kind of brought up in doing this show is that I got involved right at the beginning, a lot of dementia-friendly community meetings, those kind of things.
Yeah.
And I look around the room and there wasn't anybody living with dementia in the room.
Yeah.
And like you're saying, unless you can actually experience that, then how, for somebody who's never experienced it, can you actually make any logical decisions about anything?
Yes. Yeah. And I think, you know, there's always a sense of good intent behind some of those. But, you know, we have dementia friendly communities activities here in Australia as well. So we've got, you know, a whole number of alliances and communities that are forming together to create more inclusive environments. And one of the hallmarks of that, and in fact, you know, I got longer ago than I care to admit, came over to the UK and spoke to some of the Alzheimer's Society teams that were working on dementia-friendly communities at the time. And one of the earliest decisions we made was that people living with dementia had to be at the heart of any kind of community activity. So the work that we did with communities was very much around how to engage with and involve people with a living experience of dementia and improve their understanding that somebody with a cognitive impairment doesn't automatically lose capacity to participate in everything, or indeed in anything in some cases, that, you know, that there are ways of maintaining that engagement in a way that is meaningful and important, and it does have an enormous impact on how a community approaches something. So that's been a kind of really strong feature of the work that we've done, because often, you know, there is a misunderstanding about how dementia impacts a person. There's a sense that as soon as there's a diagnosis, somebody doesn't have capacity or independence or the ability to make decisions. And, you know, having worked with people living with dementia for, you know, more than a decade, it is, you know, absolutely not the case. For example, we have a Dementia Australia Advisory Committee, which is made up entirely of people living with dementia, and they provide strategic advice to the organisation and have a really close link with the board of Dementia Australia to ensure that, you know, their voices are being elevated at the highest levels of governance. We have, you know, board subcommittees that do include people living with dementia who have specialist skills in the area that that they're contributing to, but, you know, they're not excluded from those governance conversations as a result of a diagnosis. So, you know, really starting to kind of tackle some of that pointy end misunderstandings in a sort of really direct way.
Kate's Easter Nutritionisms are brought to you by Eat, Drink, Think Nutrition.
My second Easter Nutrism concerns a different type of egg, this time the chocolate ones. So I'm sure you've all enjoyed your chocolate Easter eggs over Easter. However, don't forget to prioritise dark chocolate eggs. This typically means chocolate with at least 75% cacao content. This is often recommended by nutritionists because dark chocolate has significantly lower refined sugar content. This is the type of sugar that's not great for your blood sugar balance or sustaining energy output. Dark chocolate is also rich in fiber, magnesium, multivitamins, and a category of phytonutrients called flavanols. These confer anti-inflammatory benefits for the whole body, and with particular reference to the brain, they support blood flow, focus, learning, memory, and mood. However, if 75% dark chocolate is a bit too bitter for your palate as a standalone treat, you can easily finely chop or grate a daily square onto food and into meals instead.
You know, that's the way to do it, really, isn't it? I mean, I know of a charity that actually got a lot of business people together in a room, and they had a couple of their charity members living with dementia. They didn't actually tell anybody. Why would you? These are just people that have come. And when they said at the end, did you realise that, you know, X was living with dementia? These people were absolutely amazed.
And,
you know, I've got friends living with dementia, and one of them always comes up with the words. He says, people come up to me and they say, you don't look like you got dementia.
That must be one of the most annoying things for someone living with cognitive impairment to hear, because, and we, you know, our advocates tell us that all the time, that, you know, someone will say, oh, you don't seem like you've got dementia, or you must be doing quite well, you know, which I suppose is in some ways a compliment, a backhanded one still. But I think the recognition that a person living with dementia can still continue to, you know, make a contribution and be and that contribution is meaningful is really important. But also understanding the weight of symptoms. You know, I remember one of our advocates saying to me that she has to work really hard to function at a day-to-day level and appear, you know, quote unquote normal. And it comes at a cost. So the, you know, the level of fatigue and tiredness that she has after a day of meetings, for example, is really significant, because she's had to work really hard to maintain that cognitive independence. So I think, you know, there's kind of both sides of the equation that we need to understand when, you know, we are working with or supporting somebody that's living with dementia, because it's, you know, it's hard work to it's, you know, they're on kind of constant cognitive overload all the time. So it can be really challenging. And I think, you know, there's things that communities can do that can make a real difference to that, in terms of having quiet times in shopping centres, in having quiet spaces that people can go to, being mindful that, you know, that when there's lots of sounds and noises, it can be quite disorienting or difficult to sort of navigate through that, making sure that the physical environment is inclusive of everybody. Those sorts of things make a huge difference, and you kind of need to understand a little bit about the mechanisms of dementia to know what to do in that space too.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a couple of things in there really, isn't there? I've got a theory that a dementia-friendly society, let's take the word out, dementia out of it, because a lot of this stuff, you know, quiet space, I'd like quiet space in the supermarket, thanks very much. A lot of it would benefit all of us. And
absolutely,
beginning of the conversation, you were saying about the difficulty with the health system. I was the man who filled out an 84-page form for my mother-in-law when she was living with dementia. Now, Let's simplify it for everybody.
Absolutely. Yeah, that is it. And I mean, I think one of our advocates once said, if you get it right for dementia, you get it right for everyone. Yeah. And that is really absolutely the case, because it does create a more inclusive environment and community in which people can be supported at, you know, wherever they're at, which is really important for all of us, irrespective of whether we have a cognitive impairment or not.
Do you think, you know, in terms of words that we use, you know, words are important, but particularly in this area, and every, you know, I'm sure you get asked the question, everybody I've spoken to in 7 years gets asked the question, what's the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia? Dementia being an umbrella term, I always say to people, I had a cancer diagnosis 4 years ago, things are fine, whatever, you know, everybody listening knows that. But first time I said, I've been diagnosed with cancer, first question anybody asks you, which type?
Yes.
If someone says I've been diagnosed with dementia, they never ask that question.
No. I think that is certainly the case here too. I think there is still general confusion about dementia and how many different forms of dementia there are. I think probably not dissimilar to the UK, there's more of a focus now on the subtype of dementia, particularly from a diagnostic point of view. And I think that's partly reflective of kind of where we're at from the science point of view. You know, before, obviously, it was really only possible to diagnose dementia definitively after someone had passed away and you know, got a good look at their brain. With technologies now, we've got a better sense of where there might be shrinkage in the brain, what parts of the brain are being affected. You know, there's better genetic indicators, there's better markers of proteins and you know, kind of where they're accumulating in the brain and the type of damage that's being done. So I think when we talk to people living with dementia here in Australia, there's often a better sense of types of dementia, noting that, you know, no diagnosis is absolutely definitive, and of quite a few people that we speak to have, you know, been diagnosed with, I don't know, frontotemporal dementia, and then it's been changed to Alzheimer's disease as their disease has progressed. So, you know, part of it is interpreting symptoms in a particular way by the specialist. But I think that, you know, more broadly in the community, we still, I mean, one of the most common questions I've been asked when I've been, you know, interviewed on different radio stations and things is, oh, is Alzheimer's disease the same thing as dementia, or is, you know, is it the, so there is still a lack of understanding. And I think, you know, which always kind of breaks my brain a little bit, because so many people are impacted by it. And when you know, go into a room and ask people to put their hand up if they either have a direct or, you know of somebody that has been impacted by dementia, most of the room put their hand up, and yet it's still so misunderstood, which, you know, is a real challenge and something that organisations like Dementia Australia are trying really hard to shift the dial on, but it's difficult. And I think, you know, unfortunately, over the last decade or so, people's understanding hasn't really significantly shifted, because I think people, the fear factor means that people don't want to talk about it or think about it until they have to.
Kate's Eastern Nutritionisms are brought to you by Eat, Drink, Think Nutrition.
My third Eastern Nutrism is to revive the Easter egg hunt in a safe and secure environment, of course. An Easter egg hunt is neuroplasticity at work. The egg hider has to think up clues and hiding places, which often requires new and inventive thought processes and revives memories of your surroundings, whilst the Easter egg seekers have to use their mental ingenuity to discover the eggs. Furthermore, an Easter egg hunt offers both the egg hider and the egg seeker a bit of physical activity on Easter Day and Easter Monday, which otherwise runs the risk of being quite static and chocolatey. this benefits brain health because movement is one of the greatest generators of a specialized protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, which is also known as fertilizer for the brain. So an Easter egg hunt over the Easter holiday is full of brain-beneficial challenges and quick wins.
You know, what's happened here, I think the media play their role. We've got, I think we've got one story going on a soap at the moment. But the problem with that is because of the medium and to keep the listeners, they have to fast forward everything. So it's not really a true representation. You know, what's the kind of media take? You know, we're full of headlines here every now and again. Eat more strawberries to cut your dementia risk.
Yeah.
Or, you know, this drug invented here or there. And it's kind of hope, but false hope.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we get the same here. I think, you know, one of the challenges is that we want to be able to demonstrate that there is exciting research going on, and there is, right? Like there's more than 130 clinical trials going on globally. And for the first time, probably in about 25 years, even though the newer drugs like lecanemab and donanemab, have been passed by our drug administration here, they haven't been subsidized. So they're not as easily available, but you know they're really the first drugs that have been available on the market that have any impact on modifying the progress of the disease for 20 plus years. And so people do want to talk about what's happening in that space because it is really important. But you know, we often talk to researchers about responsible reporting on this stuff because, you know, a news headline might be, you know, potential cure for dementia. And then, of course, people see that, seize on the hope of it, and it turns out that it's a phase one clinical trial that, you know, is being tested on laboratory mice or starfish or whatever. And it's, you know, it's not really going to have any immediate effect, or even for medications that are available, that they're not necessarily going to be available to the full population, and they're you know, likely to have a limited efficacy. So kind of responsible reporting can be difficult. And, you know, a lot of the calls that we get to our National Dementia Helpline are at times when there is stuff in the media about it, and, you know, we do have to counter that. We've probably had one story fairly recently on Home and Away, which I think you get over there as well, where one of the characters was diagnosed with dementia. And we were fortunate that one of the actors in that soap is actually one of our ambassadors and has a personal experience with dementia in her family. So she was able to ensure that the storyline was handled quite well, and that rather than having that fast track, because as you say, there is that fast track, that that the character was diagnosed and then took off to to have sort of some adventures and things while she was still able to do that. So it was kind of a bit of a different way of approaching it, rather than sort of the fast track to get diagnosed one day and you pass away the next. Yeah. So that was quite a good representation, I thought.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Kate's Eastern Nutritionisms are brought to you by Eat, Drink, Think Nutrition.
My fourth Eastern Nutrism offers a nod to the green leafy vegetables. Now, it's likely that we've all slightly overindulged in chocolate over Easter. However, the spring greens are seasonal at Easter time, so don't be reticent in indulging in them as accompaniments to your traditional Easter meals, because asparagus, purple sprouting broccoli, cabbage, lettuce, rocket, spinach, and watercress are all in season in April. Green vegetables and salads tick almost every health offering box. They are rich in minerals, calcium, magnesium, and iron, as well as abundantly offering anti-inflammatory, antioxidant polyphenols, vitamin C and E, and fiber. So they also confer gut health benefits. And what's keeping the gut healthy is often simultaneously keeping the brain healthy too. The green leafy vegetables and salads are also rich in B complex vitamins, which help regulate any excessive buildup of a potentially neurotoxic substance in the blood called homocysteine. So this is naturally occurring. It's a byproduct from the breakdown of a protein building block amino acid called methionine. It's just that if levels happen to reach excess during this metabolism process, this may impair cognitive function if left unregulated, or if you are potentially deficient in B vitamins, which are readily gained from the green leafy vegetables and salads. It's also important to emphasize that green vegetables and salads are not just for Easter, because although they are seasonal at this time of year, they can readily and easily be included as accompaniments to meals and snacks all year round.
It's tough understanding, you know, all of this with everything that's going on. You know, in terms of the kind of message about risk factors, which is, you know, probably emerged in the last few years. Alzheimer's Disease International, a report a couple of years ago, was all about risk factors. We've got identifiable risk factors. And, you know, how does it go? It's almost selling that to a younger population. If you do this now, then, you know, this may not happen in the future. But I guess that's it's a bit of a difficult sell when somebody's in their 30s.
Exactly. Well, it's a difficult sell for two reasons. But A, because, you know, when you're young, you think you're bulletproof, right? So, people are not necessarily inclined to think about their heart health or, you know, am I likely to develop diabetes? It's kind of like, I'll worry about that down the track. So I think there's a bit of that involved in it. And the other challenge we've found in talking about brain health more broadly is that for somebody already diagnosed with dementia, it's a bit like, well, thanks. Are you telling me that I brought this on myself? So we've had lots of conversations with our advocates, so, you know, people with living experience that we talk to about a whole range of things, because we don't want to put people offside and you know, suggest inadvertently or directly that by, you know, not focusing on their modifiable risk factors, they brought it on themselves, because it's absolutely not the case, and it's certainly not. It's more complicated than one or two risk factors alone, and, you know, genetics and age and family history and all of those things play into it as well. So it is quite a complicated area. But, you know, for us, I think that there is, given that we don't have significant disease modifying treatments, I mean, I think, you know, ultimately the goal perhaps for research now is to have dementia become like other chronic diseases, that, you know, you are able to manage the symptoms, pick it up early, manage the symptoms and not, you know, and manage the progression of the disease. And I think, you know, if that's the case, one of the things we do need to focus on is how we improve people's understanding of risk factors and what they can do to modify their risk. And often that's not well understood. We did a survey a couple of years ago and, you know, all of the survey participants said that they would be interested in what they could do to reduce their risk of developing dementia, but they didn't think there was anything that could be done. So, you know, there is still a lack of understanding out there that there are things that you can do to modify your risk of developing dementia. It doesn't guarantee it, but it's certainly helpful. And, you know, it generally tends to have a pretty positive impact on your cardiovascular health or your risk of developing diabetes as well. So I think it is really important that we start to focus on that. And given that kids are, you know, often engaging with their grandparents or friends of grandparents that may have dementia, it's an important, you know, it's important that we start talking about it as early as possible in the way that we do with other diseases, and improve people's understanding that there is some stuff that they can do that, you know, that may make a difference.
Yeah, do you think, you know, before I kind of started all this, I was involved in public health for a while. And during that time, dementia was never mentioned. And I think you just brought it up there in terms of, I don't know if mainstreaming is the right word, but put it in the same box as all those other chronic illnesses, whereas, you know, there's certain things that go on here with provision of care, financial, etc., which set it apart from things like diabetes, coronary heart disease.
And
we want it in the same box.
Absolutely. We've done quite a bit of work looking at how to build references to dementia into preventative health strategies, because pretty much all of them didn't have any reference to dementia. So that, you know, that's been something that we've focused on. And as much as, you know, a health strategy is a piece of paper, if it's not even referenced in there, then it's really difficult to start to build in some of those important shifts in understanding. I think, you know, probably here in Australia, there was a sense for quite a number of years that if you were tackling the risk factors, it didn't really matter what disease it was referencing, right? Like, you know, if you were focused on cardiovascular risk factors, then you would sort of see the behavior change. But I think people, you know, need to have that connection, because given that, you know, dementia is something that everyone is really fearful of, if they don't realize that there's a direct connection between some of those risk factors and the development of a particular condition, then they're less likely to be motivated to do something to, you know, change their risk. So it is something that we've been focused really strongly on in Australia, making sure that we're starting to embed references to dementia into, you know, broader population health and broader public health messaging and preventative health strategies and those sorts of things. And we have actually, you know, as part of the sort of advocacy work, we've been calling on government to actually fund a national brain health and dementia awareness campaign, because it's an important shift in people's understanding.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, you know, when I first started this show, someone said to me, "Why did you do it?" And I said, "Well, my grandmother was a very Victorian London lady, lived till she was 101. And when her friends were in the pub all talking, anybody mentioned the C word in those days of cancer, all went hushed. And it was, you know, they didn't want to talk. Now that paradigm's changed.
Yes.
But as far as the D word is concerned, that's where everybody goes hushed.
Yes, exactly.
You know, get people talking about it, take the mystification and, everything out of it.
And I think, that is largely driven by fear, which is understandable because it's, it is difficult to live with. It's difficult to support someone who's living with it. It is incredibly challenging. So it's understandable that people don't want to think about it unless they or talk about it unless they have to. But what that means is that there's this perpetuating kind of misunderstanding and silence around it that that doesn't need to be there and makes an enormous impact on those that are affected. It's such an important shift for people to not have the hush, right? To not feel that they can't say that they're affected by dementia directly or indirectly because it's going to make other people uncomfortable. I mean, that's something we've got to shift.
Well, we've got Dementia Australia, people like you, people all over the world. I've spoken to people on every continent, I think, in the last 7 years. And I think the one positive thing for me is that we're all pulling together. I've spoken to people that have said what you're saying, what I'm saying, and there are pockets of people all over the world that are thinking exactly the same thing. And I think that's powerful.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been doing a podcast for the last few years that we started called Hold the Moment, and it's co-hosted by a well-known journalist and television reporter and radio presenter, Hamish McDonald, and Jim Rogers, who's living with young onset dementia, and the two of them get along brilliantly. Like, it's such a wonderful dynamic. But, when we first did the podcast, we were hoping that, we'd get a few thousand downloads and sort of generate a bit of interest in it. And I think we've ticked over, we're just finishing off our third season of recording the third season, and we've ticked over more than 250,000 downloads, really? Which is incredible, and, way more than we were expecting. But I think it shows the genuine interest, and I mean you've got very big audience numbers as well globally, and I think it shows that people are hungry for this kind of information and content because it impacts so many of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I heard an edition this morning. It's excellent. I listened to one, so I would urge people to go out there and listen. Sadly, time is bringing us to a close. It's been really fascinating, Gail. It's been great to talk to you. We'd like to sign you up now as our Australian correspondent for the D Word, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Very happy to.
Brilliant. Well, we'll get you back on the show without a shadow of a doubt. But for now, anyway, thanks so much for being my guest.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks to Kyle for a fascinating glimpse into what's happening in Australia and, of course, agreeing to be our new correspondent. Also, thanks to Kate for the nutritionisms. She'll be back in the summer with more great tips. That's all for this week. Thanks to Angela, my production assistant. Next week, I'm going to be talking about young onset dementia with advocate and author Julie Hayden. So until then, thanks for your company and take care now.